Thank you very much for that. I'd like to invite our last four speakers up to the stage to take part in, both questions for the recent speakers, also a more general panel debate. If the two people I saw having their hands up last before the break still wanted to ask a question, Tim was one, and there was someone. Now everyone's put their hands up. I was only thinking one person. I'll give Tim, and then we'll do it normally.
So, Tim Lenton from the University of East Anglia. My question was on this framing issue. I was actually going to use the example of this terminology, solar radiation management. It seems to me, unlike carbon dioxide removal, which is a very literal description of what you're doing, sunlight reflection or solar radiation reduction or something like that might have been a more apt term. And yet, Royal Society and others have endorsed a terminology that carries this management connotation with it, and I can't decide in myself whether that's a good or a bad thing, because what it does do is it opens up a recognition and get people thinking in the public domain about the implications of what we're really talking about here, as has been nicely outlined by some of the speakers, that you really are offering up a challenge, the idea that we'd have to try and do this technology for many generations, many, many generations. And I think, like my former mentor Jim Lovelock and some others, that this is a very tough ask. But maybe it's helpful in the public discourse to have a word that makes you begin to explore some of these implications socially and politically of what we're talking about. But I guess the question would have been to Nick to say whether in the public engagement you're thinking about trying different framings of the same technologies. So offer up one idea. Technology described as solar radiation management, offer up the same thing with a more literal label on it, like reflecting sunlight. Does it affect people's perception? And then going beyond that, I think I support what many people have hinted at, which is that we've really got to get away from this umbrella term geoengineering and away from these umbrella terms of CDR and SRM and get down to talking about specific technologies. Because as Bob said, I mean, No one, who objects to afforestation? But if you mix it in with mirrors or sunshades in space, well, you're not just mixing apples and pears, are you?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's a comment for me. Well taken. I mean, I think solar radiation management is actually a very technical phrase. If you really, we understand it, but if you put it in front of people, they're going to have trouble because it's got radiation. What does that mean? It's got solar in. What does that mean? And then there's the management thing as well, so it doesn't really say what it means. And that's why I guess some of us trying to think about survey questions are struggling. I don't think our questions were the perfect ones to actually get these concepts across in a much more straightforward way for people. So it might have been better to have a better term. The problem is, like biotechnology, these terms have a life of their own. Once they've been used by august institutions, they become embedded in the discourse. So how you then change that? But there could be some interesting experiments around change the name of the frame. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Did anyone else want to respond to Tim's, or
we go to? I would say that we already saw the emergence of the CDR and SRM terms, just in the last year and a half, out of this larger, more ambiguous framing of geoengineering. And I think that as the, as knowledge develops, that there will be some unpacking of that in the way that you've talked about. So I agree that something, like the term biotechnology becomes part of a framing. It is still early enough to diversify that a bit.
Take the three questions from the front, and then I'll spread back. Fight over them.
Hi, Jane Long from Lawrence Livermore. I'm really bothered a bit by the framing of this problem as whether or not to engineer the Earth. I think there's a sort of moral equivalent in the United States. We just have gone through this tremendous health care bill debate, and one of the striking comments of some woman commenting in a public forum was that she said she wanted to get the government's hands off my Medicare. And to some extent, and for those of you who don't know, Medicare is a federal program. So, you know, the lack of understanding on her part that the fundamental nature of Medicare was a government program is kind of a moral equivalent, in my view, of the fact that we are engineering the earth. I mean, this is the Anthropocene. We are responsible for these changes. And so to me, the framing of this, of whether or not to do it, is actually very deceiving. And I think that the right framing should be about the intentionality issue, not whether or not we're geoengineering. And in talking about this intentionality, it leads you to very much to Bob's comments about vested interests, the intellectual, institutional, and economic vested interests that we're all faced with. So I would really like to hear comments from the panel about how to deal with these vested interests and the full breadth of them. I think we talked a little bit about the economic ones, and we know a lot about how to handle those, much more than the other two. But the institutional and the intellectual vested interests are equally going to play in this, as specified, I think, by the or as illustrated by the common occurrence when we talk about geoengineering in various fora, that the scientists who are portraying their research results are perceived as wanting to go out and do geoengineering. And that isn't necessarily where they are. They want to do research on it, but they don't want to do it. But, you know, in a room like this, people will come into the room and think that all of us are crazy scientists that want to do geoengineering, which isn't the case. And the motivation of these people is that they are very often, some of them probably do, but a lot of them are really afraid of what's happening, and they're trying to develop options. So that whole dynamic about vested interests, how it's perceived, and what we do about it is something I think we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to. So your responses would be welcome.
The only way that I know one can deal with vested interests in the first instance is by letting the light in, is by exposing what it is that's going on out there, by providing people with information about sources of income and influence, by working as far as we possibly can towards increased levels of transparency in a way that is becoming more available now, and ensuring that we have the means to do that. I'm worried that a lot of this letting the light in is done by cash-strapped NGOs desperate to find any money at all to unearth and winkle out relationships that should be in the public domain anyway. And when, this may be a bit controversial, but when scientists are party to covert relationships of that kind, and choose not to assist the cause of transparency by ensuring it's in the public domain, I think that's a pretty heavy burden they bear.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I think one has to find out what's in the self-interest of the different vested interests. Most people and most organizations work on self-interest, so the question is, what is the self-interest? How does one move it? China and India, the self-interest is they will potentially be more adversely affected by climate change than most of the OECD countries. And so their vested interest is how to bring together economic development in the short term at the same time as protecting their rather weak water resource base, the arable land resource base, etc. Within the industrial community, I think it's a question, do they see opportunities for new products that meet environmentally friendly technologies that can help us transition to the low-carbon economy. So I would see personally in the US that the driving force will be a potentially unholy alliance of moving this forward of the private sector, some of the religious groups, etc., and not necessarily the government in the short term. But I think we have to understand what are the motivations. It comes back to understanding behavior. What's the motivations of all the different players? And can you put a package together, unholy as it might be, to actually move the agenda forward?
Do other members of the panel have a comment?
I agree with the openness, but certainly in the energy and behaviour domain, there are all sorts of vested interests, and how do you get around that? How you don't just get people to buy low-carbon cars. You regulate so the information is there and the manufacturers have to produce low-carbon cars. So regulation has a role in all of this. It's not fashionable to talk about regulation, but I think in this area, governments are going to have to look at it quite carefully to control some of the vested interests.
Jonathan, thank you. That was a terrific talk. Thank you very much. It was a message I think this community really needed to hear. And I think in particular, I am personally, I could say, very frustrated by colleagues in this community who speak as if we have to do this because we failed at mitigation, as if that failure must go on in the future. Mitigation is, compared to lots of other things we do, comparatively cheap, and it's a moral decision we've made over the last decades not to do it. And that's a moral decision we can reverse any time we want to. And I think being absolutely clear about that is crucial to moving forward. But I guess I'd like to hear more comments from you about how to operationalize what you said. I mean, basically, you were very right, I think, to point out some of the blindnesses in this community, but how do you suggest we do better other than just being more transparent, which, of course, I agree with, but I'm looking for more specifics.
Oops. I was having a very interesting discussion with Tim over tea and coffee about how these debates can be managed. I'm not too worried about the word managed, by the way, in certain contexts. Can be managed to secure the most benign outcomes. And I was just reflecting, having not really thought about biochar at all as an issue up until about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, and now watching the way that debate is sort of going on and feeling that it's both constructive, benign, differentiated, with lots of people having very clear, distinct voices, nobody really going in, trashing anybody else. I'm sort of struck by that as a model of how to do the kind of discussions around this that makes a lot of sense. And maybe that's one way in which we can make some of these discussions work a little bit better. Okay, that isn't really an answer to your question. I want to come back to what Nick ended by saying. I'm a great believer sometimes in cutting through the nonsense and going for level playing field establishing regulation quicker than spending years trying to do suboptimal voluntary self-management in a way that businesses just always take advantage of. I mean, one thing I've learned, I hope Bob doesn't mean I'm being too cynical, is that businesses are so good at playing the game. They are just brilliant at manipulating whatever level of leeway governments choose to give them. That's what they're there to do. That they employ lawyers to make sure that that's what they do. I'm not actually attacking them for this. That's what their shareholders want them to do. But God, they're so damn good at it. And governments are not good at it. They don't really like to play that game in the way the business do. So for me, I want to go straight through these layered, complex processes around voluntary guidelines to some stuff that impacts on everybody in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. What I would simply say is, addressing this issue is going to take some technological evolution. We've got to put a price on carbon one way or another, whether it's through a trading system, whether it's a straight carbon tax. But we also do have to look at behaviour change. So it's not, is it regulation or is it behaviour change? It's how do you get the right combination.
Okay. And I'd add from the perspective of research that we really are, we operate without strong governance at our risk. This is a, you know, there's a lot of research that could have results that are either willfully misinterpreted or genuinely misinterpreted, or that could go wrong. And we're protected by governance as well as controlled by it. And I think that we ignore the benefit of that at our own risk for the very severe liabilities that could be out there.
We could take a question here and then one at the back on the side.
I wanted to make 2 points, one on presentation and one on governance. On presentation, I think that we've heard very well from Jonathan Porritt and Bob Watson, and I don't think that any of us would disagree with what they say. But in a way, when you face a major problem, which is being misrepresented as this happens, Some of you may have seen this book called Merchants of Doubt, which it deliberately shows the efforts being made to misrepresent the issues. When you've got that, you've got to think very carefully about the best way of presentation. And my usual policy on these matters is that when you can't solve a problem, you change it. By which I mean to say that you want to present this issue in rather different terms. I find that if you address an audience on global warming, for example, you will switch off a lot of people immediately. If, on the other hand, you address them on climate destabilization, which is what we can already see, then people begin to realize their vulnerability. And Bob Watson has already referred to the extreme sense of vulnerability, which is evident in India and China at the moment, not to mention Brazil and Mexico. So in a way, you want to present the problem in terms slightly differently from before and realize that you've got this tremendous climate vulnerability, climate destabilization, which can already be seen and for that reason can already be acted upon. Now, when you come to global governance, subject on which I feel strongly, because once upon a time I was the British ambassador to the United Nations, and I know how difficult it is to get to change institutions and to get anything working. When I was there, I did try quite hard to get some kind of recognition of the whole range of environmental problems. Now, I remember I raised it once in the Security Council, and I was more or less laughed to scorn, and I never got anywhere. But since then, I have tried, and a number of other people have too, to try and present the idea of creating a World Environment Organization to bring together all the different organizations that cover the environment, and in which, of course, the question that we've been discussing during the last 2 days would be prominent. It would be much less controversial if you could come under an umbrella and people wouldn't think that, in fact, the scientific world was trying to replace the need for action on climate change with a whole lot of fancy ideas about geoengineering. So I would very much commend that, and I think that we must once again look at it. We need to work it out and see how it would, in fact, work, whether you'd be able to create an organization of this kind. And I believe that with effort, you can. Change takes place for three really main reasons. Once when you get a bit of leadership, once when you get pressure from below, and once when you get some catastrophe which makes action indispensable. Now, I don't think we want any of those three instantly at this moment, except we could certainly do with some leadership, and I think pressure from the scientific community is very helpful. But let it be done in a way that doesn't, as it were, feed some of the useless controversies. Now, a moment ago, somebody referred to the Anthropocene. I don't know how much you're all aware of the geological proposals to create a new geological epoch, beginning with the Industrial Revolution some 250 years ago, when the Holocene becomes the Anthropocene. In other words, when our small animal species begins really to change the character of the Earth, requiring measures to cope with the kind of things we are doing. And I think that it's quite useful to think occasionally in terms of the Anthropocene when you're thinking of new institutions to bring this together, in which the role of geoengineering must play a subsidiary part. But above all, I commend what Jonathan Porritt and Bob Watson have said, because they have shown very clearly where we now are and where I think we now have to go.
I suppose my only comment on the World Environment Organization, which the Germans and the French have been pushing very aggressively for probably about 10 years now, maybe even so. I think my only question is, will it add anything? Why has UNEP failed, or why has UNEP not lived up to the expectation? I think it's simply now the environmental issues are very different from when we actually developed UNEP in 1972, where the environment was viewed as something separate from development, something separate from energy, something separate from health, from agriculture. And so I think this organisation, if it were to be developed, has to recognise that environment is now an integral component of everyday development. And so possibly it could work, but I'm not sure it would add anything. I'm not sure, Sir Crispin, whether it adds anything to actually debating geoengineering if and as needed within the UNFCCC. I'm not sure. So I think the question is, what would the mandate of a World Environment Organization be? How would we make sure it worked where UNEP has got some shortcomings, etc.? But it's clearly something that has been debated and is still very much alive as a debate.
Can you hear me? It doesn't sound right. Andrew, can I start? Andrew Lockley. I'd just like all of the members of the panel to imagine for a second, according to their gender and or preference, that they were king or queen of the world. And I was to hand them a big red button with SRM clearly marked upon it. And I wonder if I could ask each member of the panel, at what point or under what circumstances would they personally press that button? And secondarily, do they think that the geoengineering community will have the button ready for safe use by the time that they might wish to press it? No wriggling, please.
So who would press a button? You don't have to answer whether you'd be a king or a queen or whatever.
Well, clearly, if I was queen, I'd need some new clothes. I view that if geoengineering is needed, it would be to complement a low-carbon economy. And so I would hope, if I had any influence in the world, that it would be to try and move aggressively forward on the low-carbon economy while still supporting the research community to do more research. And I'll be honest, hoping that I would never have to press the button of the complementary geoengineering solution. So my approach would be, if one had any power, is to really aggressively move the low-carbon economy through an international agreement.
Okay. Sorry,
Margaret. I think that... you know, I agree with Bob that process has to have taken place. And I think that anyone in their right mind would not press a button, given that it was available and that meant that we had done the research, we had some idea of what the consequences of this would be, unless they were asked to do so by some larger process, by some international process, as Bob has said. It's not an individual decision. And I think that it's a very serious thing to embark on. And we got a feeling from them about how long we might be pressing that button. And it's not something that you would do without an international consensus.
Okay.
I wouldn't press the button until the price of carbon had gone to $250 a ton, because it strikes me that if we use markets properly, we've got so much in the innovation pipeline. I look at what's just waiting to come to our support there, and it's, for me, just ludicrous that we're still fossicking around in this hydrocarbon age. So that would be the first thing. Secondly, I'm not sure I'd press the SRM button until we'd really done the carbon dioxide removal stuff to the full, because I'm much more comfortable in that space than I am in the SRM space, I have to admit. And I'd like to see a lot more being done on that. I'd like to go hell for leather about stopping deforestation in the first instance, then afforestation, then biochar. All of these things I'm reasonably comfortable with, possibly out of a position of ignorance, who knows. I'd like to see a lot more air capture stuff moving forward, because I'm quite excited by that. And if carbon was at $250 a ton, presumably it works. Yes, I thought so. So at that point, you might actually be able to get to the point where you didn't need ever to press the red button.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I have a button answer?
No, there are two answers, aren't there? There's one way, if you think about it, as complementary to all other techniques. So one does behavior change, one does low carbon technology and other things, and that's still not enough, and therefore you're kind of topping up. So that's a non-catastrophic decision. And then there's this kind of catastrophe plan B, everything else has failed. Both of those are not scientific questions. They are political questions, because the whole notion of acceptable risk has a scientific component, but it has a political component as well, or a value component. So I wouldn't do it without proper consultation. I mean, that sounds a very weedy kind of answer, but I'd want to hear what people in the third world want to think and know about it, people in other countries who are likely to be affected by the proposals. So I think there's the whole dialogue thing has to be opened out at an international level as well, if we're going to go anywhere with this. So.
Gentleman from Lancaster, I can't believe I can give him a little end off, and then we'll take a question from the two-thirds, the way back in the middle.
Yeah, Bron Szyszynski from Lancaster University. I just wanted to ask the panel about intellectual property, because, you know, the first Oxford principle is that geoengineering should be done as a public good, but then obviously there's lots of sub-questions about what that means, you know. And it's great that so many of the researchers that have spoken here have said that, you know, they're committed to their research being open source and not privately owned and so on. But a recent report from researchers at the University of Michigan talked about a steady rise in patent applications for geoengineering techniques. And what was interesting was they noted two things about this as well, that as well as the rise, there's that the patents tend to be very broad in their definition of what's being patented, which opens up issues of control, but also potential litigation and so on if people start doing those techniques. And secondly, that they tend to be concentrated in quite a few actors and few parts of the world. And they do make suggestions about what might be done to sort of, you know, if people share their concerns about this. But I wondered what the panel thought can be done. You know, it's great that, you know, the sort of nice middle of the sandwich, if you like, you know, might have very good instincts about keeping this all a public good and in public, not under private control, but there are many actors out there who have different intentions. I'm wondering if people have reflections on what might be done about that.
I don't know enough about how legally one can constrain private interests legitimately going through IP and patenting processes within the laws of the lands of the different territories as they exist today. I have no sense that there's a legal remedy to that at the moment, other than to ensure that what is coming into the public domain is able to compete with what is being protected under legitimate patenting and IP processes, a bit like Craig Venter. Not sure how his name goes down in this community, but like Craig Venter, in the end, didn't get his nemesis by being regulated into not doing something, but because there was a flat-out competition with public interest science to get to the same point. Now, I read that rather positively at the end of the day, but I'm short of legal knowledge here, so I'm going for a bit of a kind of hopeless generalization, really.
I think we said in the Oxford Principles that in principle there was, under that public good, there was no bar to the private sector being involved in an area of science and technology. But it's an unfortunate kind of model to use. But the defence model is that all our weapons are built by private companies generally, but they're certainly not let off by private companies because we make sure that they don't do that. That doesn't stop them selling to other people, etc. Like, so it's not as straightforward as it looks, but there are kind of models where there's enough societal will and control over something that is of necessity, maybe much of it produced in the private sector, and I don't know, that may be one way of looking at it, but I admit it's not an ideal way of looking at it.
I think there's also a difference between the scientific side, the discovery side, that both the Oxford principles and the Asilomar principles focus on as being public good, as rapid transfer of all data to the public realm as possible, versus someone who might develop the ideal nozzle for the release of XYZ particle, which is that intellectual property would not control the deployment or the capability of use in the same way that intellectual property around particular reactions or that kind of science would be there. So I think that's part of this discussion about the principles of governance. Where does this community of researchers and all of the communities that surround us and must be part of that discussion draw the line in terms of disclosure, and that then draws the line in terms of what can be privately owned intellectual property or not. But I think that that's very much part of the discussion that we have to have.
Tim, if you've got a direct question or comment on this, I'll jump to your head. And then if we can get a microphone to the lady back there, and then we've got two immediate questions on the either side of the aisle down in the middle.
Tim Kruger, Oxford Geoengineering Programme. I think that this issue of intellectual property is a very important and interesting one, especially with regard to transparency. We've seen the problems of the lack of transparency in other areas, such as genetically modified food, and that has then created where you've had intellectual property driving secrecy in pharmaceuticals, where you have commercial interests leading to the concealment of negative results. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really important. In addressing Jonathan's point, governments can decide not to grant patents. They can decide that it is not in the national interest to do so. They can also, a patent, and it is a complicated legal area, but they can decide to rescind a patent. And that's happened in Brazil with relation to drugs for the treating of AIDS. Pressure with that regard has led to much cheaper drugs for AIDS in developing countries. So there is something that we can do. There is also, last year there was something called the Manchester Manifesto, published by Professor Sir John Sulston, amongst others, who is the Nobel laureate. And he asked the question, who owns science? And there is a general acceptance that the rules that we have for patents are perhaps no longer serving our society best, and that we need to re-examine this, and that this is a very good place to do so. With regard to geoengineering, the work that is being done commercially is predominantly in Europe and North America. And you can look at the benefits flowing from those patents, flowing to UK PLC and US Inc. And I would remind you of the definition of a racket. And the definition of a racket is a business that makes money by selling a solution to a problem which the business itself has created.
Anyone have a comment on that? Or so we have the question there.
I was at the CBD negotiations, and it's interesting to reflect. I would recommend everyone looks at the decision made on geoengineering there, because both the Royal Society and ETC Group played a major part in hammering out that decision. The Royal Society sent a representative, ETC Group had a representative there, and I'd be interested to know what your thoughts on that subject were. I'd like to ask Jonathan Porritt about confidential business information as one of the barriers to transparency. And finally, just quickly to ask each of the panelists what their main method of increasing public trust in whatever field connected with this, what their main activity would be to increase public trust.
Would you see CBD?
No, she asked you. Because I never saw what the
confidentiality of commercial, corporate information is a difficult territory. I mean, there's no way a competitive marketplace is ever going to override the interests of commercial confidentiality. So there will always be a bar to all information coming into the public domain at the time where it might be most helpful to others. That's the nature of a competitive market. And actually, I'm not sure I'm that worried about that. I think that's slightly different from the IP point of view, which is when companies are in the business of developing new products, techniques, services, whatever it might be, of course they've got to protect their confidentiality. I see that as a given. Once the product's out there, then these things pretty quickly get into the public domain anyway. I'm less fussed about that than I suspect you might be.
On the public trust issue, I mean, what I think we would need is a series of really well-written articles
in major newspapers that actually frame geoengineering in the full context of climate change, of what are the risks of not mitigating climate change, what would we have to do to adapt, how could we mitigate by going to a low-carbon economy, what could we do to adapt, and what could the potential role of geoengineering be. So I'd hate to see just sort of what I call snapshots of one part of geoengineering. I think the public needs to have it placed within a framework of the whole climate change debate, understanding what we know and what we don't know, what are the risks and what are the benefits of moving forward. The trouble is the sort of newspapers in the UK that will do that would probably be The Independent, The Guardian. You'd probably get good articles there. You might get something decent in the Times and the might in the Telegraph. But most people don't read those newspapers. Most people read The Mail, The Sun, The Mirror, etc. So how one gets across to the majority of the public is indeed a real challenge, basically. And that's why I don't think we have the public anywhere close to where we need them, just on the climate change debate itself, let alone the geoengineering debate.
I'll comment that I wasn't at the CBD negotiations, so I don't know the details of all the conversations that went on. The point I was trying to make in my talk was that for an organization that sought to put constructive pieces on the table that would lead toward governance, that it was very narrowly focused. It didn't really address all of the environmental issues that even the research community had expressed concern about. And the point again of reading this, if you wanted to go ahead with this, would you be able to under the regulation, was to point out that it was so poorly constructed in that sense that it allows a country that really wants to avoid any kind of governance the opportunity to do so. So I have no problem with the issue of governance. I thought I made that very clear. I do think that particular attempt was not particularly well framed.
On the trust issue, I'll come back to what I said about the House of Lords Science and Society report of 10 years ago, which is worth reading. After BSC, they actually diagnosed there'd been a collapse of trust in science. They recommended openness and transparency as much of it as you can do. In fact, there hadn't been a collapse of trust in science if you looked at the evidence. That what had happened was there'd been a failure of trust in certain aspects of governance of science and industry, particularly within the Ministry of Agriculture, which Bob will know, the forerunner of bits of DEFRA. So they were right for the wrong reason. So the first thing is openness and transparency. You can't not have that. And actually, it's interesting the pulling back of some of the external independent bodies who were meant to provide that, Human Genetics Commission, Food Standards Agency, no, but almost, and Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. A number of these are now going to be reabsorbed into government, and I think that's not necessarily a good move in relation to the whole science and society agenda, but that's an aside. On what the research evidence says, we trust people for a number of reasons, but there are three main ones which you can work at, and they're not all necessarily congruent. So aside from the transparency and openness, we trust people because they're experts, we trust people because they're concerned for us and care about us and don't have a stake somewhere else. They're not kind of doing something behind the back which will finally catch us out. And we trust people if they've got shared values with us. Expertise, I think the evidence shows scientists have always, being scientists, you've always had expertise in the areas of domain of science. And even the UEA thing, I don't think, would have dented that. So I don't think the science community should feel worried about that. The concern, lack of stake, actions and words, I think, have to match. And again, transparency and openness is really important for that. And then the shared values is very difficult because this whole domain is riven with values that are rather different. So we can't pretend, some of us, to be exactly in the camp of the right wing gung-ho geoengineering people. So how you deal with that, I'm not sure. And deliberative processes say you can't deal with it. You just bring the values around to the table and try and work out which bits overlap and where you might find common ground. So those are kind of three ways of thinking about trust.
We take a question from
My first point is that I sort of raised it with people privately and here in this debate, and they've more or less agreed with me. Some excellent points have been made in the last three things, but there still remains the business, the amount of media attention, which has been in the last year or so, actually giving too much credence to denialists and making it rather difficult for the scientist, expecting to be pilloried to have a degree of integrity that's not found in any other section of society. My second point is concerns something Jonathan Porritt said. I think he had a very good point about us being sort of nice filling in the middle of the sandwich between the extreme Greens who won't countenance any sort of measure and the extreme other side, the denialists, who again don't want to do anything. But also, I don't think Jonathan would like... I'd like him to perhaps do a bit more about schisms within the Green movement itself. And the last point, again, for a lot of what Jonathan was saying, he seems to very much want to play along with the prevailing... what I call neoliberal ideology. We all seem to be... Everybody here seems to be... Every contributor seems to be more or less from the Anglosphere. We haven't heard of many contributors from... I would have liked to have seen some Chinese scientists at this debate, not for balance or political correctness or anything, but just because they might have a useful perspective. Certainly we've had a very useful perspective on economics from Harjun Chang's book, 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. So we shouldn't regard things like patents and intellectual property rights as good things that necessarily need to be upheld. Maybe we need to change our tune on that altogether and try and get away from this ideology in which we're all steeped. Try and look at things from... But maybe we need a different politics before we can do anything effective about climate change.
If I could get... if Jonathan just replies that, time is starting to creep up to five. If I take two more questions here in the white shirt, and also the guy at the back who's been holding his hand for about an hour on the aisle. There may be other people who've been holding their hands for hours, but...
Yes, well, the idea that we're going to have to change the global economic system before we sort out climate change has always worried me just a tad, in that everybody does seem to be, in one form or another, hugely excited about capitalism. Even in China, they are very excited about capitalism. It may not be capitalism as we know it, but boy, it is a form of capitalism which is quite something to behold, close up or from a distance. So I've honestly stopped kind of trying to sequence my mad radical thoughts, and now just try and get as much as we can. On schisms in the Green Movement, yeah. I mean, look, talking about the Green Movement is almost as crazy as talking about geoengineering. I mean, the Green Movement is a vast polyglot, heaving mass of diverse competing interests, worldviews, philosophies, tactics, strategic interests, vested interests, blah de blah. And to call it the Green Movement is just a little linguistic simplicity. It's no more than that. I've always celebrated this diversity. I wouldn't call it a schism. I'd just call it proper let a thousand green poppies bloom adult debate.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrew Johnson. I run a website called checktheevidence.com. I'm probably in a minority of one in this room. I've been watching the CO2 issue being propagandised for the last 20 years, and we've seen a number of high-profile sceptics come forward, thankfully, over the last few years to question the whole basis on which many of these presentations have been given. People know about that. It's already been mentioned several times. However, I myself have come to an even more sort of different conclusion that geoengineering is already taking place, which I will be giving out some leaflets. So if people want to come and see me on the pavement afterwards, they can find out more about this. But I'd just like to read out a statement which was given in 1961.
We do need a question, if it leads
well,
to
I just want to make a point in terms of freedom of speech and intellectual sort of freedom, really, and this is based on what President Eisenhower said in 1961. And I think it's very appropriate to what some of the remarks that have also been made in terms of, you know, the whole science and the way that we're engineering the environment, because this is what Eisenhower said in 1961. The free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. And from my own research, which obviously I wouldn't have time to go into here, I do give 2-hour presentations on this, that is exactly what's happened. And I really think that people in this room do not know the extent to which it's already happened. So I'd just like to make those thoughts available to people to consider. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for that. If we take a last question, and if when we've had the last question, if the panel also want to address your comment, then they should feel free, except he doesn't yet have the microphone.
I want to make a comment about two issues, the issue of global agreements and the issue of intellectual property. And both of these get to the point of the dangers of using the general phrase geoengineering. On the issue of intellectual property, I would argue that for direct air scrubbing, we should very actively encourage the development of intellectual property, because this is a reasonably benign technology, and we don't need any global agreements. I mean, if I'm scrubbing CO2 out of the atmosphere here and putting it in the ground, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. On the other hand, for solar radiation management, yeah, at some stage we're going to need a global agreement, but for entirely different reasons than we need it in other aspects of the climate debate. Here, I don't need everybody to play. I only need one player, and so the point of an international agreement is sort of the inverse of the point of an international agreement for emissions control. But there I am very concerned about the development of intellectual property, which might lead to lobbies to start engaging in this. As a matter of fact, with the Vermont Law School, we plan a workshop to look at ways to limit intellectual property in the SRM area. I can't answer for other countries, but in the U.S., the only example I've been able to find so far are national security-related restrictions on the development of IP, but we're continuing to search.
So last chance for the panel to answer that or otherwise comment.
I mean, I don't think we could disagree with you on the air capture, with the one exception, and that is we all need to be sure that if this is done on a whole series of individual levels, that the storage is long-term. If the storage suddenly gets released, then we've got a potential problem. So I think what the world would we need to understand are the storage facilities, whether it's an aquamarine sulfur, whether it's a depleted oil well, etc., was likely to lead to long-term storage and not to sort of short-term leakage. I think that would be my only comment. I think you're right on if we're going to do something on solar radiation management. I personally think we would need an international agreement on it. On the other previous...
But we don't need the agreement to do it. We need the agreement about the circumstances under which someone might do it, because this is something that can be done unilaterally at $1 billion a year or something.
After there's an agreement, what would the criteria be to allow someone to do it? Yes, that I would agree with. I think on the media, we've got to do a much better job of regaining the trust of the media. After the IPCC event, after the issue of the UEA emails, I mean, I went on television at least 12 times. The standard approach was I could not be there alone. There had to be a skeptic with me, which is 6 of the 12 times was Nigel Lawson, the well-known scientist. And so effectively, and there was basically an agreement within the television studios that there always had to be two points of view. Many of the environmental writers lost the confidence of their editors, thinking they'd gone native. And what we saw at the end of the day was a 100-page of accusations against IPCC and UEA for every one page of retraction after the three independent assessments cleared them of all wrongdoing. Absolutely. And so there was no balance. And what I've been trying to get across to The Guardian and others is, yes, there's two points of view, but 95% of scientists, supported by really strong evidence, this is why there's not belief, there's evidence of human-induced climate change. Point out there are some skeptics that point out this is not one skeptic for every scientist that's got strong evidence. And so we've got to frame the debate better.
If there are any last comments from the panel? If not, then it remains me to very warmly thank the panel, both for... Hang on. I've got a whole range of thank yous. I mean, both for participating in the panel, also for their excellent and very stimulating talks this afternoon. I would like to thank my co-organisers of the meeting. I would really like to thank the Royal Society. It's thinking of the red button 3 years ago, pressing the red button for meeting, and then they've done all the hard organising people like Scott Keir. Also thank the two people who have been running around with the microphone. So both, if you would like to join me with thanking the panel, all the speakers these 2 days, and particularly the Royal Society for hosting this event.